Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Glenn Ford, executive editor with the Black Agenda Report, who discusses the nationwide protests responding to a New York City grand jury decision not to indict a police officer in the choking death of Eric Garner. Matthew Ho, a former Marine and State Department official who resigned in protest over U.S.-Afghanistan policy, who takes a critical look at President Obama's recently revised strategy in the Afghan conflict, America's longest war. And longtime peace activist Mark Colville, who talks about his recent court proceeding for protesting the U.S. drone warfare program at an Air Force base in upstate New York. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a clear expression of support for a two-state solution to the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the lower house of the French parliament recently voted 2-1 in favor of a non-binding resolution to recognize a Palestinian state. The mostly symbolic move follows similar resolutions in Britain, Ireland, Sweden, and Spain, with the French vote tallying much lower in percentage than elsewhere in Europe, but also being cited as perhaps the most important. This past summer, violent protests took place on the streets of France, home to Europe's largest Jewish and Muslim populations, in response to Israel's military campaign against Hamas. After the conflict in Gaza, France's socialist president François Hollande was criticized for expressing solidarity with Israel and has made considerable effort to distance himself from the vote. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned that a favorable vote would be a, quote, grave mistake, end quote. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas praised the French vote as a courageous and encouraging step, while the Israeli embassy in Paris condemned the measure and raised the issue of anti-Semitism. The European Parliament is set to debate and vote on a resolution recognizing a Palestinian state in mid-December. In recent weeks, European foreign ministers criticized Israel's expropriation of land near Bethlehem on the West Bank and the continued expansion of Jewish settlements near East Jerusalem. In 2012, Palestine was upgraded to a non-member observer state at the United Nations, and over 130 countries have recognized Palestinian statehood. In early October, former Chicago police commander John Burge walked out of a minimum security federal prison after serving only 3.5 years of his sentence for being convicted of lying about the torture of over 100 African-American men in custody over a 20-year period. Burge was released to a halfway house in Tampa, Florida, until his sentence runs out in February 2015. The cost to Chicago taxpayers is estimated at over $120 million, with $64 million paid so far in settlements to the victims and $22 million in ongoing pension payouts to Burge's collaborators. Burge was convicted of perjury in 2010 for his role in leading a ring of white police officers who tortured black men using electric shock, suffocation, and mock executions in order to get false confessions. The city of Chicago has paid $20 million to defend Burge and his collaborators in civil lawsuits. 4 years after his felony conviction, Burge continues to receive a $50,000 annual police pension. According to the news magazine In These Times, a legal team from the People's Law Center identified 118 cases of torture committed by Burge and other officers. For years, Burge received political protection from police supervisors, Cook County prosecutors, and former Chicago Mayor Richard M. Daley, who delayed prosecution until the statute of limitations had run out on various crimes of torture. As many as 20 victims still remain behind bars, and 65 claims are currently being heard by the Illinois Torture Inquiry and Relief Commission. On the eve of Labor Day, top anti-union campaigners gathered at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., to launch a new drive to undermine workers' rights by pushing the potent weapon of so-called right-to-work laws in city and county governments across the U.S. Conservative John Russell, director of the American City County Exchange, a new offshoot of the Koch brothers-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is pressing a legally questionable strategy of using the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act to battle unions at the local government level, targeting traditionally pro-labor states like New York, Ohio, and Illinois. Former National Labor Relations Board member Wilma Lieben told The Nation magazine such local laws would conflict with the national policy of creating unified labor relations law. Still, Lieben says some conservative federal judges could find the anti-union argument persuasive. The National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, which could provide some of the legal muscle for the push for local right-to-work measures, has had a lengthy string of cases that seemed like long shots when they began, only to have a conservative Supreme Court ultimately agree with them. It appears that the labor movement may be facing a new front on the war on workers to defeat unions and depress wages. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Days after protests erupted across the country in response to a Missouri grand jury decision not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown, another grand jury decision in New York City further provoked dissent. A Staten Island grand jury decided not to indict police officer Daniel Pantaleo, who used an illegal chokehold that killed Eric Garner, an unarmed 53-year-old black man. This despite a cell phone video that captured the entire July 17th incident that began when police officers attempted to arrest Garner for allegedly selling loose cigarettes on a sidewalk. Reacting to the grand jury decision in the Eric Garner case, protests exploded from coast to coast, where angry demonstrators condemned a broken judicial system that appeared once again to ignore stark evidence of unprovoked police violence in black communities. Many protest organizers and demonstrators linked the disproportionate number of police shootings in minority neighborhoods to the drug war, where blacks and Latinos suffer more frequent arrests and harsher prison sentences than their white counterparts. According to a 2009 report by the Sentencing Project, African Americans make up 12% of the nation's drug users, but represent 34% of those arrested for drug offenses and 45% of those in state prison for such offenses as of 2005. Your reporter spoke with Glenn Ford, executive editor with the Black Agenda Report, who discusses why he believes recent cases of police brutality have reached a tipping point and mobilized unexpected levels of dissent nationwide. He also examines the momentum now present to build a national movement that can effectively challenge a system that fails to recognize and address the root causes of police violence in communities of color across the U.S.
There is a new crop of young black folks at the core who we haven't seen playing this kind of role in a very, very long time. We have to go back to the 60s when 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds were taking the political destiny of their community in their own hands and not deferring to older folks. You got to go back to SNCC and later, of course, the Black Panther Party to see this kind of organization and momentum among that kind of demographic in black America.
What about the wider significance here? It was often said in the early protests right after Michael Brown was shot in Ferguson, Missouri, that what's needed in this country is not just a moment of protest, but an actual movement developing to stay on the case here and really confront some of these well-entrenched issues that have not been confronted effectively in all these decades.
And what's been very important in this particular movement in the making is that it has re-energized much of the remnants of the Occupy movement of a couple of years ago. You see the same young actors there. They jumped right in. And so although, of course, at the core, this is a black movement, there was a non-black cadre of folk who eagerly lent their organizational skills to making this a national type of phenomenon. That's what gives this movement in the making the punch that we've seen in the last week or so.
Glenn Ford, after the decisions in Ferguson and New York City and the protests, there's been a lot of discussion in our media about prescriptions for confronting police violence in communities of color. Yeah. There's been talk about allocating money for body cameras on the police themselves to record interactions, better training, special prosecutors to replace local district attorneys with conflicts of interest. There's been discussion also of stopping the militarization of police departments nationwide and strengthening civilian complaint review boards. But I'm wondering, as you look at all these solutions being offered here, is there a larger issue that's being missed in this post-Ferguson, post-New York City debate?
Well, the logic of this movement is that it is ultimately going to be a challenge to the legitimacy of the state itself, that is, the state as it is embodied in its coercive organs, the police. I think what's really significant here, especially with the young people in Ferguson, is that they have not put the addition of more black police anywhere near the top of their agenda. Although Ferguson is only a town of about 30,000 people, it's actually part of Greater St. Louis. And that black population, much of it a new population, comes largely from northern St. Louis. St. Louis has been a majority black city for a long time. St. Louis has had a black mayor. St. Louis has had a black police chief. And yet, black folks get shot down like dogs on the streets of St. Louis with regularity, just like in any other big city. So those young people in Ferguson had no illusions that the problem was simply that there were only three black police out of a total force of 50. That's a problem, but that's not the central problem. The central problem is police as an institution acting with impunity. It's a problem of relationships of power, a community that is powerless to protect its own children, powerless against the coercive organs of the state. That's the central problem, and those young people know that very well.
If you would, tell our listeners about the links that you see between mass incarceration, police violence in communities of color, and rising income inequality and unacceptable rates of poverty all throughout this country.
Well, mass incarceration exacerbates all of those ills that are legacies of slavery and, in fact, creates a probably, one could call it a qualitative difference. You know, black youth don't have to just show that they have the skills to get a job, to handle being in the labor market. They have to prove that they're not criminals. And that's why the unemployment rate for black high school graduates is higher than for white high school dropouts, because white kids don't have to prove that they're not criminals. After the triumph of the civil rights movement, new mechanisms of control had to be established, and what they did was criminalize black folks and say that this was a colorblind regime. It wasn't directed against people because of their race, but because they were criminal. If you launch a counterinsurgency or preemptive counterinsurgency campaign, a permanent one against a people, then of course the cops are going to treat people like enemy combatants, and of course employers are going to treat these folks as not worthy or trustworthy enough to have a job. So it all is linked together.
That was Glenn Ford, executive editor with a Black Agenda report. Find more analysis and commentary on the issues of police violence in communities of color by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On December 8th, Western military commanders gathered in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, to symbolically lower the flag, closing the joint U.S. and NATO headquarters for the International Security Assistance Force, signaling the coming end to the coalition's combat role in the war-torn country. According to U.S. General John Campbell, commander of the ISAF, coalition forces will soon be downsized to a force of about 3,000 soldiers to train and support Afghan troops. While the ceremony in Kabul was in sync with President Obama's May 27th pledge to end U.S. combat operations in Afghanistan by the end of 2014, according to the New York Times, the president signed a secret order in November that laid out a very different scenario. That order authorizes the U.S. military to carry out missions against the Taliban and other militant groups that are deemed a threat to American troops or the Afghan government. The report says that the new authorization also allows American jets, bombers, and drones to support Afghan troops on combat missions. Outgoing U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel announced on December 6th that up to 1,000 more U.S. soldiers will remain in Afghanistan than originally outlined, totaling an estimated 10,800 into next year. An agreement signed in September by Washington and newly elected Afghan President Ashraf Ghani authorizes American forces to be deployed in Afghanistan for at least another 10 years. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Ho, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, and a former Marine captain who in 2009 resigned his State Department post in protest of American policy in Afghanistan. Here he takes a critical look at President Obama's recently revised strategy in the Afghan conflict, America's longest war.
Previously openly stated by the Obama administration that this year would be our last year in Afghanistan, and then it would be our last year of combat, put combat in quotes, and then about a month ago or so, the New York Times reported in a leak to the New York Times, in secret, closed-door meetings, the Obama administration decided to continue American troops' combat mission and combat role in Afghanistan. The number is now, rather than 10,000 troops, it's actually going to be 11,000 troops. So there has been this reverse momentum occurring, this reversal of the get out of Afghanistan dynamic that we've been seeing these last few years has been reversing. I think there's a number of reasons for that, but primarily it is to not allow the Republicans to have a political victory or score political points by claiming that our withdrawal from Afghanistan was precipitous or that it somehow is going to allow for terrorism to spring forth from Afghanistan again, just as they're claiming now that President Obama was too quick to pull our troops from Iraq at the end of 2011, and this is why Iraq is in the current state it is, something I completely disagree with, but the White House is afraid that that will happen again, as well as, too, they are afraid that they'll lose air bases. They are afraid that they know that their ability to create this Afghan security force that was going to be able to fight the insurgency didn't work, that by escalating the war, by refusing to negotiate with the insurgency, by refusing to address the legitimate political grievances that the insurgency represents, by going along and sanctioning three incredibly fraudulent elections and continue to send billions of dollars every year to one of the most corrupt governments in the world, that there is still this gigantic rift in Afghanistan politically and that they're no closer to seeing a resolution to the war than at any time in the last 13-14 years. So I think for those reasons, you're seeing the United States under the Obama White House refuse to completely withdraw from Afghanistan, which is a mistake because it will just our presence there will continue to fuel the insurgency. It will continue to prop up, even though it is a different administration, a different regime in power now in Afghanistan. In my opinion, you've basically just rearranged the deck chairs on the Titanic. You switched out maybe the top people, but for the most part, the rest of the regime in power in Afghanistan is composed of incredibly corrupt men and women, many of whom have extensive ties to the drug trade or who are warlords themselves.
Well, Matthew, for those who are not well acquainted with the situation on the ground in Afghanistan, it does appear that the Taliban insurgency threatens to overtake Afghanistan once U.S. Forces are no longer at the forefront of the fight. And there are people in this country who are concerned about Afghanistan becoming once again a launch pad for terrorist attacks. Maybe you could speak to any alternative policies.
I don't think the Taliban are strong enough to retake the country again, and that's primarily because I don't believe the Pakistani government would support them the way they supported them in the past. If you look at how the Taliban took power in the mid-90s, it was because they were the favorite horse of the Pakistanis in that country, and they took power based upon an upswell against the warlords who were destroying the country by the people, but also because they were flush with Pakistani rupees. And when they fell in 2001, it was a bit because of our military power, but a lot of it because the Pakistanis pulled their support, particularly their cash, from them. So I don't think they would be able to retake the country as they did. The problem, though, and this is where this is instructive, and this is where we should learn as a nation in our dealings overseas, is that in 2009, when the administration was debating what to do in Afghanistan, the Taliban did make offers to us to negotiate. It was actually widely reported in Afghan, Iranian, Pakistani press. I was serving there as a political officer of the State Department. I had approaches made to me. Others had approaches made to them by the insurgency. It was known to us that we don't want to surrender, but we also are sick of the fighting. Now, they also had their hardliners, too, who believed that God was on their side and God would see them through and that God would help them triumph over the Americans. Well, we decided to reject all those offers. In fact, we lied about it. If you go back and look and see what our administration says about the Taliban in 2009, they outright lie. They say the Taliban is not interested in negotiation, therefore there's only a military solution. Again, complete lie. Taliban were willing to negotiate in 2009. So in this case, I think in Afghanistan, you're going to have this violence play out for a while, which is a terrible thing to say. But until you reach some point where there is some degree of political accommodation made, where the government in Afghanistan decides to negotiate and talk with the insurgency, they're not doing that now because we're continuing to provide them with billions and billions and billions of dollars every year, as well as maintaining tens of thousands of troops there. Over the next few years, as that gets reduced, we'll see what occurs.
That was Matthew Ho, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on the Afghan War by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Longtime peace activist Mark Colville was convicted in September of 5 misdemeanor charges related to his December 2013 protest against drone warfare conducted by the 174th Attack Wing of the Air National Guard at the Hancock Air Force Base in upstate New York. At his sentencing hearing on December 3rd in Syracuse, New York, Judge Robert Jokel told Colville in a pretrial conference that if he declined to accept the plea bargain offered and was convicted in court, he, the judge, would sentence him to the maximum of just over 2 years in prison. Colville, who with his wife Luz runs the Amistad Catholic Worker House of Hospitality in New Haven, Connecticut, is the father of 4 children. He's been arrested for peace actions many times over the years. In this case, the judge decided not to sentence Colville to jail time because he said it would serve no purpose to do so. Instead, some conditions were attached to his release, and the failure to comply with them could send him to jail. Conditions included not being arrested in New York State for a period of 1 year, payment of a fine of more than $1,000, and providing the court with a DNA sample. Colville, however, was defiant and said he had no intention of complying with the court-imposed conditions. Several other activists in the anti-drone protest movement in New York State have been sentenced to jail time over the past year. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Colville shortly after his conditional release. Here he explains that his protest took place in the context of a broader movement to end drone warfare and wants the focus to remain on the victims of U.S. drone attacks.
This was a nice outcome for me, but the drone attacks continue. And just yesterday, in fact, 4 people were slaughtered in a house by a drone strike. So we still have a lot of work to do, and particularly at that drone base, the people are continuing to organize and to try to resist the crimes that are being committed.
Do you have any idea what the judge meant when he said it would, quote, serve no purpose, unquote, to sentence you to jail or to supervise probation?
There have been a steady stream of trials going on in that court, half of them presided over by him, and then there's another judge there as well. And the penalties have been getting progressively worse. I mean, they just sentenced a 76-year-old former school teacher to 3 months and then 3 years of supervised probation. And then a grandmother of 3 was given a year for a charge that under which I was also convicted. In fact, I was convicted on 5 separate charges for simply peacefully walking to the front gate of the base with a written plea from an Afghani man whose family members were killed in a drone strike. And, you know, for that, I was tried and convicted on 5 separate charges. So, well, I mean, what that means, I don't know what it means. It certainly means that the judge has been acting a bit erratically.
Mark Colville, when protesters are arrested for misdemeanors, they often just pay a fine rather than go to trial and risk jail time. Since you've done this several times in the past, you obviously see value in going to court. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, specifically in this particular case, this man, Raz Muhammad is his name, he had written a plea to the courts in the United States and to the government and military to stop the drone attacks. And in this handwritten letter of his, you know, he explained what had happened to his family, you know, victims of a drone strike. His brother-in-law was killed and several of his friends. And so he was describing that and what life was like for the family now, you know. So we went to the base with the plea, and to my mind, I wanted the plea to be heard in court. I wanted his letter to be read in court. And in fact, I was able to have his letter read in its entirety in open court as I cross-examined one of the military personnel who had taken the stand as a witness against me. In general, when I do acts of civil resistance, it's very important to me to go to court because really, I mean, the courts in so many cases, the courts are acting in concert with the government and the military in the perpetuation, not only perpetuating these injustices, but legitimizing them. In the case of drones and interventionary war and all, I mean, it has to do with the courts ignoring the law. They ignore not only applicable law, but superseding law, you know, like constitutional and international law, which forbid the kinds of attacks that the United States is perpetrating with drones. And so, to me, it's an essential part of the witness and the action to be in court, to go to court and to put the question to the court members and to the judge particularly, to take the responsibility, you know, of applying the law. In other words, this case is not about somebody trespassing on a military base. It's not about disorderly conduct or those, you know, any of those other petty little charges that they want to exclusively focus on. It's about, you know, what's going on behind the gates of that base. I mean, one of the charges I was given, one of the more serious ones, is called obstruction of governmental administration. And the way that statute reads, you know, a person is guilty of that if they obstruct the lawful administration of government. Of course, my contention in court was that what the government is doing at that drone base is not lawful. And so, you know, I tried to take apart that statute and have a fair hearing on whether the drone policies and what they're doing there at that base is legal. And, of course, most points along the line there, I was, you know, my defense was shut down because they don't want to engage those questions.
That was Mark Colville, a member of the Catholic Worker Movement and peace activist involved in protest actions against U.S. drone warfare. Learn more about groups opposed to drone warfare by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.